Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. The rapidly spreading monkeypox outbreak can be stopped, an official from the World Health Organization said on Tuesday. It comes after WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus on Saturday declared the spread of the virus to be a public health emergency of international concern, the organization's highest level of alert. Through this, WHO hopes to enhance the coordination and cooperation of countries and all stakeholders, as well as global solidarity, Dr. Rosamund Lewis, WHO technical lead on monkeypox, said.
We do at this moment still believe that this outbreak of monkeypox can be stopped with the right strategies in the right groups, but time is going by and we all need to pull together to make that happen. Because at the moment the outbreak is still concentrated in groups of men who have sex with men in some countries, but that is not the case everywhere. It is really important to appreciate also that stigma and discrimination can be very damaging and as dangerous as any virus itself.
Dr. Lewis said that WHO had assessed the risk of monkeypox in the European region as high and at the global level as moderate. With other regions not as severely affected, the declaration of a public health emergency was necessary to ensure the outbreak was stopped as soon as possible, she added. This year, there have been more than 16,000 confirmed cases of monkeypox in more than 75 countries. Dr. Lewis said the real number was probably higher. Amid continuing hopes that the first shipments of stranded grain could leave Ukraine's Black Sea ports within days, 50 tons of different humanitarian supplies, initially destined for another hard-hit location, have been delivered to the severely affected government-controlled settlement of Stepnohursk. Due to the ongoing hostilities, UN and humanitarian partners have been unable to deliver any assistance to non-government-controlled areas since the start of the war. In this instance, the town of Polohi could not be reached. According to the humanitarian coordinator for Ukraine, Osnat Lubrani, medicine, food, blankets and supplies for children were delivered to Stepnohursk and will also be sent to the neighboring town of Primorsk. About 5,000 people in urgent need will benefit from the items delivered. Ms. Lubrani called on all the parties to the conflict to allow life-saving aid to reach those most in need. The UN Stabilization Mission in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, MONUSCO, has strongly denounced an attack on its headquarters in Goma on Monday. Protesters stormed the UN base in the eastern Congolese city, demanding the departure of peacekeepers from the region. According to MONUSCO, the attack was carried out by a group of looters on the sidelines of the demonstration. Hundreds of people blocked roads before storming the mission in Goma, as well as a logistics base on the outskirts of the city. Protesters smashed windows and looted computers, furniture and other valuables from the headquarters. Acting head of the mission, Kashing Liang, called the violence not only unacceptable but completely counterproductive, calling for restraint. He pointed out that MONUSCO supports the Congolese authorities in protecting civilians against armed groups and in its efforts to restore state authority. Chaos and confusion or division will not make progress towards stabilization and peace, he added. Over 120 armed groups roam the volatile region, and resurgent clashes between local troops and the M23 rebel group in eastern Congo have displaced thousands of people, with civilian massacres common. Katie Dartford, UN News.
Good afternoon, listeners. We'll have John Grant in the second hour. We're going to be discussing a recent New York Times article on Kansas amendment to the Constitution. Proposed vote is August 2nd, coming up very soon. So join us in the second hour. And as a reminder, tomorrow on Radio Free Kansas.
The National Weather Service reported the Springfield Twister was the biggest storm to pass through central Illinois in a decade.
The West Texas wildfires have scorched so much land that it's like watching more than half of Rhode Island burn.
Biggest one I've ever seen.
I love to drive. You could say I'm an autoholic. My life began in a car, so Dad tells me. I discovered sex in the back seat too. Made my own kid there. I may die out on the road. When things get boring, I drive around looking for something else. And if it's no good here, I go there. Too hot? We'll just go north into the hills. Too cold? Off south, just like the birds. Sometimes, I don't even know why I'm going. I'm just out there on the road, rambling around. I've just got to get out there and drive, maybe for a day or two, and see some country, some trees. I need to see nature. I've worked in vehicles and slept in them, even lived in one. Can't count all the hours I've just waited somewhere with the motor running, for red light, for traffic to move, for somebody to come out, for anything. Who even hears the motor running there under your thoughts? Vibration is good, moves the blood around. We don't even smell these engines unless something's broken. I've driven them all. Motorcycles, three-wheelers, minis, SUVs, compacts, pickups, a limousine, a truck, tractors, golf carts, you name it. If it's got a motor, that's good for me. And the power, the roar, the jolt of energy, the thrill of speed. I've got this armored steel that can run away, or run over, or damn near fly. My ride talks for me, tells you who I am. Without it, I'd just be a naked little animal out there in the rain and snow, like a snail without a shell. Likely I wouldn't kill for fuel, but my taxes pay for soldiers who will, by God. Gotta have gas. And if by accident I had to run over some kid, heaven forbid, or some old fart, I may lose my license for a little while. But I'll keep driving. We all need to get around. Okay, the weather is getting really weird. You never know what might happen. If this place floods or burns, I'll toss my stuff in here and go somewhere better. I'm not walking around like a loser. Notice anybody else getting off the road? Not likely. On my dying day, when I go, it'll be sitting upright behind the wheel. Check out Radio EcoShock, the planet's only all-environment radio station at www.ecoshock.org.
And again, that's tomorrow on Weather on Wednesday on Radio Free Kansas right here. Coming up now, the latest, absolute latest, today's headlines, global news from Democracy Now!
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Pope Francis has apologized for the abuse of indigenous children who were separated from their families and sent to church-run residential schools in Canada, where they face psychological, physical, and sexual abuse. Pope Francis is on the apology tour since Monday in Moscouches, Alberta, the site of a former residential school.
I myself wish to reaffirm this with shame and unambiguously, humbly beg forgiveness for the evil committed by so many Christians against the indigenous peoples.
The Pope's apology comes 7 years after Canada's Truth and Reconciliation Commission accused church-run residential schools of taking part in a form of cultural genocide. The commission also determined more than 4,000 Indigenous children died from neglect or abuse in residential schools from the late 19th century through the 1940s. Unmarked graves are still being found. We'll have the latest on the Pope's historic apology tour after headlines. In Tunisia, President Kais Saied has claimed victory in his bid to gain sweeping new powers after winning a constitutional referendum in an election boycotted by most opposition parties. An exit poll showed over 93% of votes cast were in favor of changing Tunisia's constitution to grant the president broad executive power with greater control over the parliament and judiciary. But turnout in Monday's election was very low, with fewer than 2 million people casting votes in a country of over 9 million registered voters. Opposition groups said Saied is bringing authoritarian rule back to Tunisia after an uprising against poverty and corruption swept aside longtime leader Ben Ali in 2011, inspiring Arab Spring protests across North Africa and the Middle East. In Ukraine, Russia's militaries fired missiles at several targets on the Black Sea coast, including in Mykolaiv and the southern port city of Odessa. The attacks came even as Ukrainian officials said they were just days away from implementing a United Nations brokered deal to export grain and cooking oil through Black Sea ports in order to help ease global food shortages. In the northern city of Chuhiv, near Kharkiv, rescuers combed through rubble looking for survivors of Russian missile attacks Monday that hit a local school, crushed homes, and completely flattened the city's house of culture.
We're here in the very city center where the house of culture is located. There were no soldiers here. It's simply the house of culture. Now we see what's left of it. The house is completely in ruins. There is no chance of rebuilding it.
Russia's state-controlled energy giant has reduced the flow of gas through its main pipeline to Europe. Gazprom said Monday it would slash gas deliveries through the Nord Stream 1 pipeline to just 20% of normal operating capacity. That prompted the European Union to agree to a deal that grants Brussels the power to compel European Union members to slash gas consumption by up to 15%. On Monday, Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky accused Russia of committing gas blackmail against Europe. In California, at least 3,000 people have been forced to evacuate the fast-moving Oak Fire near Yosemite National Park. As of this morning, the fire had burned nearly 17,000 acres and was just 10% contained. Smoke from the massive blaze triggered air quality alerts in the San Francisco Bay Area and other parts of the region. In the Pacific Northwest, forecasters are warning of a new heat wave that could push temperatures in some areas above 110 degrees Fahrenheit. This follows record heat a year ago blamed for the deaths of 800 people across Oregon, Washington State, and British Columbia. On Capitol Hill, six congressional staffers were arrested Monday as they held a nonviolent civil disobedience protest inside the office of Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer. The staffers are demanding Schumer reopen negotiations on a bill to combat the climate crisis after West Virginia Democratic Senator Joe Manchin blocked Democrats' latest efforts to pass new funding for green energy programs. This week, 165-plus federal and congressional staffers signed an open letter to President Biden and Chuck Schumer demanding they strip Senator Manchin of his chairmanship of the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee. They're also demanding President Biden declare a climate emergency and take other urgent actions to curb greenhouse gas emissions. The letter reads in part, quote, "Even if Democrats control both chambers and the White House again in 4 years, inaction in this moment will cause an era of record temperatures, extreme drought, sea level rise, and other deadly climate disasters. We do not have years to waste. We have little more than a week," they said. President Biden says he's feeling better after testing positive for COVID-19 and expects to be working in person by the end of the week. Biden gave the update as he continued to work by video link Monday.
I'm feeling good. My voice is still raspy. I've had every morning, every afternoon, every evening, I get a full-blown series of tests, everything from temperature to oxygen, the oxygen in my blood to my pulse, just across the board. And so far, everything's good.
On Monday, Senators Lisa Murkowski of Alaska and Joe Manchin of West Virginia announced they, too, had tested positive for coronavirus. Democrats Tina Smith of Minnesota and Tom Carper of Delaware are also out of the Senate after testing positive last week. Their absences have left Democrats unable to move several pieces of legislation, including a bill protecting the right to marriage equality. This comes as cases of the BA5 coronavirus variant continue to rise across the United States, with some cities, including Los Angeles and Seattle, considering reinstating indoor mask mandates. Meanwhile, the CDC is reporting the U.S. has surpassed Spain to become the country with the most known monkeypox infections since an outbreak of the viral disease began earlier this year. The U.S. has reported more than 3,400 confirmed or suspected cases. The White House is reportedly preparing to name a federal monkeypox coordinator in the coming days, while the World Health Organization has declared a global health emergency around monkeypox. The White House has yet to do this. The House Select Committee investigating the January 6th insurrection has revealed new details about how former President Trump resisted his speechwriters' attempts to have him condemn the assault on the Capitol. A draft speech prepared by White House staffers for the president to deliver January 7th shows Trump's edits in black marker. Trump crossed out the line, quote, "I am directing the Department of Justice to ensure all lawbreakers are prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. We must send a clear message, not with mercy, but with justice. Legal consequences must be swift and firm," unquote. Trump also crossed out the phrase, "I want to be very clear, you do not represent me. You do not represent our movement," unquote. Finally, Trump edited, "If you broke the law, you belong in jail," to instead read, "If you broke the law, you will pay," unquote. In reproductive rights news, dozens of incoming medical students at the University of Michigan walked out of their white coat induction ceremony Sunday protesting the keynote speaker, Dr. Kristen Collier, and her support for laws banning abortion. In related news, thousands of people rallied outside and inside the Indiana State House Monday as lawmakers began a special session to debate a Republican bill that would ban nearly all abortions. Indiana is the first state to hold a special session to consider abortion rights since the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade last month. This is obstetrician and abortion rights advocate Dr. Amy Caldwell.
My primary objective today in testifying is to relay that abortion is common, it is safe, and that all of the proposed restrictions in Senate Bill 1 are unnecessary and harmful. My colleagues are fearful to do their jobs, fearful of being criminalized, and fearful for criminalizing our patients.
And here in New York, a man who was forced to plead guilty to theft in connection with the Central Park jogger case has been exonerated. Stephen Lopez was just 15 years old when he was arrested and wrongfully accused of sexually assaulting a white woman, along with five other Black and Latinx teenagers who became known as the Central Park Five. At the time, Lopez, whose story is far less known than the rest of the group, pleaded guilty to robbery to avoid a more serious rape charge. Lopez is now 48. He served about 3 years in prison before his release in the early 1990s. Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg announced Lopez's exoneration on Monday.
Many largely forgot that there were six who were falsely accused of rape of the Central Park jogger. Today, Mr. Lopez joined the other five who had their convictions vacated. What is so striking to me is how young Mr. Lopez was when both he was arrested and then when he pled guilty under extraordinary pressure.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
If you want to catch Democracy Now! Here in the Northeast Kansas area, you can always tune in to at 7 in the morning on weekday mornings, at 19.2 over-the-air antenna, KCPT, the local PBS affiliate, or an hour later, at 8 a.m. weekday mornings, there it is on 90.1 KKFI FM, Kansas City's community radio station. Now coming up, the latest Counterspin with Janine Jackson, produced from FAIR, Fairness and Accuracy in Investigative Reporting. Counterspin. We'll be right back.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, the internet has changed the way we communicate, access information, and even organize, which means concerns about digital privacy are concerns about privacy, period. In the wake of the Supreme Court's overturning of Roe v. Wade, allowing for the criminalization of abortion, our ability to safely access information and health care online is in danger. How are tech companies responding? We'll hear from civil rights attorney Nora Benavides, senior counsel and director of digital justice and civil rights at Free Press. Also on the show, it's good to be shocked by the news coming out of the January 6th committee. It's shocking. But suggesting that all of this is new and revelatory is a narrative that serves us poorly. For media, the test isn't so much how they are covering the hearings, but whether they're really incorporating the lessons into their regular coverage. That's going forward. But today, we'll go back to the day after the insurrection, when we spoke with political scientist Dorothy Benz. That's coming up, but first, a quick look back at some recent press. Common Dreams' Abby Zmet reports the Austin American Statesman's release of horrific video from school security cameras documenting the May 24th massacre in Uvalde. Police, of course, decried the release, no doubt because it shows their multiple abject failures. But the Statesman says after a lot of thought, they determined we have to bear witness to history. Just not all of it. In a corner of the video, they note, quote, "We have removed the sound of children screaming. We consider this too graphic," close quote. Yes, one wouldn't want the murder of children while dozens of heavily armed officers slouch around, one stopping to put on hand sanitizer, others looking for keys to an unlocked door, to upset anybody. Here's a New York Times correction from early July. Parse it if you can. Quote, "An article on Thursday about Unilever's decision to sell Ben & Jerry's business after controversy surrounding the company's pledge to discontinue sales in the occupied West Bank described incorrectly the Israeli occupation of the West Bank. While most of the world officially considers the West Bank to be occupied and the settlements there illegal, there is no consensus that the occupation itself is illegal," close quote. Just leave that one there. And finally, the Department of Health and Human Services is creating a new entity, the Office of Environmental Justice. It's a great overdue idea, but its impact won't depend on issuing earnest reports or calling for documentation of things we already know, but on the willingness to take on, among other things, the fossil fuel industry. A reminder that when the NAACP released a study a few years ago showing that more than 1 million black people live within a half mile of oil and gas wells and operations, and another 6.7 million live in counties with refineries, and that they face disproportionate exposure to pollution as a result, the American Petroleum's response was to say that health disparities have nothing to do with them and can be attributed to, wait for it, genetics. An agency that doesn't address that head-on will be of limited use. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. The anticipated but still devastating Dobbs decision aims to take reproductive health care out of the hands of countless people, and it's already having that effect. But one might think, as terrible as that is, at least a person can go online to learn how to get to the nearest abortion access point or order pills from Canada. But the same social media platforms that constantly tell us they're about building community around and through demographic and geographic barriers are not showing up hard for those values when it comes to a free flow of information on abortion access. What are they doing and what might they do? We're joined now by Nora Benavides, civil rights attorney and the senior counsel and director of digital justice and civil rights at Free Press. She joins us now by phone. Welcome to Counterspin, Nora Benavides.
Hi, Janine. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, maybe let's start with the shape of the problem. What are the concerns right now around data privacy that are generated specifically by this court ruling and other rulings around abortion access and its criminalization? What could happen or what do we see happening?
From the outset, the gutting of Roe by Dobbs is so devastating for, of course, the constitutional reasons that at one time Roe codified and really affirmed that abortion was a basic right. Dobbs, in overruling that, overturning that, has laid open states to pick and choose whether they will allow abortion providers and individuals that kind of right. But we're in a very different moment now in 2022 than we were in the 1970s. And that's really because of the rise of the digital age.
Right.
With it, as you mentioned in your opening, is that the internet is our primary pathway for almost everyone, I think, to information, to healthcare, to, you know, telehealth appointments. And so there are these huge questions now about how people will access both just information and then who is going to have access to that data that we are all of us engaging in and creating a footprint for. The number one concern is that basically anything we do on our devices is reachable and is collected, retained, even sold by data brokers. In this new post-Roe era, in the states where abortion is criminal now, which is in the dozens, police and prosecutors will be able to buy information, both location and our search history, our app usage, to build criminal cases against women and providers of abortion. And so, it's really kind of a terrifying moment where privacy is, in a very new way, the entry point for our civil and basic rights.
So in the face of that, what could social media platforms and ISPs do? I mean, a lot of them have these, we understand they simply are beholden to law enforcement. If law enforcement or the government asks for information, they hand it over. Is there something different that they could be doing in that regard?
Yeah, well, you know, so let's start from what we already know.
Right.
Platform companies are in the business of selling records to data brokers, to advertising firms. And a lot of what pre-Dobbs we've seen is that a lot of this information then allows platforms to target users with either content that they enjoy or content that otherwise discriminates,
mm-hmm.
which is its own set of issues. In addition, companies can also be subpoenaed, as you say. They can be subpoenaed by prosecutors who might be wanting the whereabouts of people seeking reproductive health care. In the last year, Google has been forced to turn over its location information about its customers when law enforcement seek court orders for that information. What's been interesting is that actually in response to Dobbs, Google has updated its privacy policy to start deleting location data about users who visit places related to their health. My organization, Free Press, has been working on pressuring Google to modify its retention and collection practices. So this is a really huge step. It's some initial victory, but that's only one company. We've seen for the last several years, other companies like Amazon have put major sets of information together for law enforcement when they seek something through a search warrant, subpoena, other court orders. All of these are within the bounds of the law. The problem is that there's that additional layer that law enforcement can actually circumvent both court oversight and other Fourth Amendment concerns by buying our data from third parties.
Wow.
So when they don't want to go through the process of seeking a search warrant, a subpoena, or another court order, police can just circumvent it very easily. They can go through a data broker and pick and choose whatever they want to buy.
Well, so what do we do in the face of this? I understand that there are certain legislative moves that are going on or being proposed. There has to be a way to address this?
Yeah. Well, I always try to start with the individual and work my way up.
Okay.
And it's always important, I think, to help affirm for people that they can seek out information. There are really wonderful guidelines now for how to protect yourself online. And whether that is through encrypted apps, using a VPN, those are important things to start learning about. There are also then the much larger, what I call kind of systemic reforms that we need to be looking at. And as you say, some of that is through legislation. You know, Congress has currently a set of proposals before it that would limit what law enforcement can buy from data brokers. One of those bills is called the Fourth Amendment is Not for Sale Act. It's a long name, but it's a really good bill, and it closes a loophole that allows data brokers to sell our information to police without a warrant. There is going to be a hearing on this bill coming up this month. Free Press has endorsed the legislation. I think that we need a groundswell of support all over the country who are saying, yes, this is the kind of privacy protection we need. We also then need more. You know, we need other agencies throughout the federal government to step in. And one of those critical ones is the Federal Trade Commission, which is tasked with oversight over deceptive practices, the kinds of things that we've described today, where people's data has been sold, otherwise used in nefarious ways. And so the FTC has before it a really unique moment to look at abusive data practices and begin creating rules around how corporations can mitigate the harm to their customers and other consumers. So I hope that over the coming months, we are going to see the FTC take this on with an open and participatory process. It's one that we call a rulemaking, where they build a record of the harms, and then we begin developing the guardrails to prevent these kinds of deceptive, unfair practices. But we need all of these things, mm-hmm. Janine. This isn't some distant threat. It isn't like women may at some point risk being prosecuted. This is already happening around the country. And so we need advocates to start telling these stories to help make the link that what we do online has very real-world consequences.
Well, first of all, it's so dystopian, the idea of our information being packaged and sold to begin with. And it almost feels like, you know, shutting the barn door after the cows have escaped.
Mm-hmm.
Just bigger picture, it makes me think about publicizing, nationalizing the internet anyway. I mean, isn't it really a public resource? And the idea of all of our information being essentially a commodity is just kind of terrifying big picture.
I agree. I mean, and yet many times when I talk with people, their natural instinct is to say that the gathering of our data actually helps.
Hmm.
You know, there's this intuitive sense that whatever I do on Facebook actually can help make my experience more unique and personalized.
Mm-hmm.
And that may be true in some instances where you start getting ads for the types of local Facebook groups that you actually might want to join.
Right.
I get that. What we have to start talking about is that there's that underbelly to what's really happening and that the internet no longer serves people in the ways that we once thought it held such promise to connect us all, to make a more equitable future. In the middle of all of that, then, I just sort of think to myself, how do we talk about these issues to help people understand there are pros and there are very real trade-offs, very dangerous ones that really strip us of our own autonomy? If you're doing something online unaware of the trade-off that as you search for something, that search result will be collected, stored, and even sold to someone, that isn't just about making your local Facebook group recommendations better or more exciting for you. That really removes any anonymity, which is something that throughout history, this country has been so committed to, at least in theory. You know, when the founding fathers dreamt up what the Fourth Amendment would be. It was early, early British rule, where crown officials would storm into people's homes and take their writing and their other belongings because it was seen as potentially threatening to the crown. And so there's this old history of all of it being centered on power. And so what we're seeing now in the stripping of and the violations of our privacy all come back to the ways that our power has been taken from us.
Well, I guess I would say we do have a positive vision of an internet that could have the good things that we want if we can build in these protections that help us in terms of privacy. We can have a positive vision going forward of what the internet could be. That's kind of the way we thought of it, you know, hopefully many, many years ago. That can still happen, yeah?
I think it can. And some of the work that excites me the most, both in my own job at Free Press, the work I see across the country now from policymakers and allies on the ground throughout the country, are people who are trying to dream up what a better internet would look like and what realized civil rights are online. One of the most exciting places that I've seen this is through the Disinformation Defense League, a network of over 230 local organizations around the country, either led by or centering communities of color. We are so often, I'm a Latina, you know, I work with groups that are considered typically on the fringes and otherwise not really at the table for large systemic conversation. And this network is one of the most exciting places that I have seen harvest and try to incubate great ideas for reform. That includes policy reform, privacy protections, civil rights protections online, things that can intervene to blunt what we see as harmful and discriminatory practices online. So I think that there is a future internet that we can realize, and we all need to have a voice and a seat at the table.
We've been speaking with Nora Benavides from Free Press. They're online at freepress.net. Nora Benavides, thank you so much for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thanks so much, Janine.
The January 6th hearings are a critical moment in U.S. politics, but their lasting impact will have something to do with how media use the revelations to shape coverage going forward. Will they continue to present a party that accepts electoral results and one that doesn't as categorically similar? We were raising questions about press coverage on January 7th, 2021, when we spoke with writer, organizer, and strategist Dorothy Benz. Let's hear some of that conversation now.
Well, the first thing that comes to my mind is Masha Gessen's warning 4 years ago after Trump was elected when they said, believe the autocrat. And in the intervening four plus eternal years, as the left and as Black Lives Matter activists and immigrant rights advocates have raised the alarm over and over again about rising political violence, about the profoundly anti-democratic, racist policies of the administration, we have been called alarmists. We have been told it's not that bad. We have been told, you know, basically to calm down. And we could see this coming, as could anybody actually who's been on social media for the last 3 or 4 weeks. This violent piece of insurrection was planned openly on encrypted channels. There were, I saw yesterday on Twitter, there was merch. There were people in T-shirts that said Civil War, January 6, 2021. So unprepared and surprised is the last thing that anyone should have been, whether that's the Capitol Police or the media covering this story.
Absolutely. Well, many people have noted, you know, refused to deny, you could say, that everything would have been different yesterday from beginning to end, including before yesterday, as you're noting, if these people were black or were brown or were disabled, you know, really anything but what they were. I would add that that would extend beyond the day. You know, had these been black people, there would be real world lasting repercussions for all black people, right? And if you complained, anyone would need to say would be like 1621, man, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The point is, talking about how differently they would have been treated if they were black, say, it's not a rhetorical exercise. It's not a game of what if, you know, that contrast is really the story, right?
It is, and it goes well beyond the obvious. I mean, so obvious that even some of the mainstream media has noted it, that Black Lives Matter activists would have been treated differently, that, you know, a Native Americans defending their land and their legal rights who were water hosed in sub-freezing temperatures at Standing Rock were treated differently, that activists who were just begging their senators not to kill them by eliminating their health care were ripped out of wheelchairs and thrown in handcuffs. I mean, yes, those are the obvious differences as opposed to the kid glove treatment that the white nationalists got yesterday. But the deeper problem is really the entire white nationalist project that, you know, as you alluded to in the introduction, this whole venture rests on. The fact that the police were so-called unprepared, I saw that word several times in the media coverage. It's not that they were unprepared, it's that they were prepared for white nationalists, which to them is not a crisis in the same way that black people demanding rights is, or that people insisting that public health care and national health care should be a thing. The problem goes much deeper there, and it is both a problem of how we have governed and a problem of how the police and the military have been central to white supremacy. Structurally, foundationally, ideologically, the function of the police has always been to defend the system as it exists, and the system is a white supremacist system. The ruling power started 500 years ago with settler colonizers. It went on to include genocide, slavery, strike breaking in the more modern capitalist era. It has never included defending democracy. That is a central understanding of how the police work. They weren't overwhelmed, you know. They knew. They just didn't think it was a problem.
It is difficult to grapple with the language around here. We're in kind of new territory, but what we do see is an unwillingness to use the terms white nationalist, to use white supremacist in connection with this kind of thing. And I think it is part of media's desire to splinter people off, to say this really is a fringe and discourage the connections between these people and, in fact, the mainstream of the Republican Party and of many U.S. institutions.
I think that is absolutely right. There's kind of two things going on there, in that I would call it a soothing effort to make this not a bigger problem, right? The larger problem is not contextualizing it in white supremacy. The larger problem is not admitting that the entire American project is a white supremacist project. You know, the media did point some fingers at Donald Trump yesterday, rightly, but they seem to exempt almost wholly the entire rest of the Republican Party. This morning on the New York Times' homepage, at least on the app, they had a bunch of quotes, and they were all from Republicans, making them look really principled, you know, Graham, McConnell, and Loeffler saying, you know, well, this isn't the right thing to do, as if these people hadn't been feeding this same right-wing monster for the last 4 years, not to mention the last 4 weeks.
Right.
So that's like one way in which the media is trying to create a respectable-looking set of Republicans in the middle of what is not that. The other is not talking about the larger shift here, which is the assault on democratic norms and the assault on democracy itself, which has moved from sort of a cloaked phase, you know, voter ID laws that we pretend are just about voter fraud or that are somehow, you know, facially neutral or whatever, mass incarceration, which, you know, disenfranchises and create second-class citizenship for, you know, millions and millions of people, moving away from that cloaked phase to this really overt phase and kind of testing what works. Like, well, let's throw some lawsuits at it. Let's try that. Let's try to, like, directly shake down some officials and threaten them. Okay, let's try that. You know, and in October, Representative Mike Lee floated the term rank democracy, you know, as if there is such a thing as too much democracy. Like, you know, don't let the unwashed actually vote. And that's exactly what it is. And that is actually both a point of continuity and discontinuity with the entire American project. It has never been a country that is a democracy, a true democracy, in the sense of a universal franchise, let alone economic and social democracy. But it has pretended for a long time that it is. And what the right is doing now is testing even that pretense, see how they can proceed. And that is a genuine fascist threat.
And that's the danger of portraying this as marginal or fringe or failed, right? Portraying it as a failed attempt because, as you and others have said, that failure doesn't mean the end of it.
No, absolutely not. I mean, yes, I've seen a couple of headlines about, like, well, Trump's on his way out anyway. And, you know, this morning as I was listening to NPR, the reporter or the anchor said, well, what did they think they would accomplish? You know, like they are talking about some kids on a playground. And it's not, you know, that they failed at overturning the election. It's that they succeeded in mainstreaming fascism and fascist tactics. That's really the point, and I haven't seen that anywhere in the mainstream media coverage.
That was Dorothy Benz speaking with Counterspin the day after the insurrection of January 6, 2021. And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the Media Watch Group FAIR, based in New York. If you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find shows and transcripts on our website, FAIR.org. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
We've got some time, as usual, and we're going to put up some music. And to remind you, at the top of the hour, John Grant comes live. We'll be discussing a recent New York Times article by Mitch Smith, which centers on Kansas and the proposal to change the state's constitution. Until then, we'll be right back.
Like to go into a thing called Ain't No New Thing. It's based on the fact that white people continue to rip off black artists. They continue to steal their material, their styles, the very cultural elements that make the black artist the outstanding artist and master of music that he has been. And it ain't no new thing, to tell the truth, that these things are going on. We point out very expressly the fact that Stanley Crouch comments on his album Ain't No Ambulances for No Niggas Tonight that Chuck Berry was doing like a very heavy thing, a very heavy rock and roll thing, the king of rock and roll as a matter of fact. But like white people couldn't dig having their daughters go to no shows and cream over no black man wiggling on the stage, so consequently they invented Elvis Presley and let him do it. So we want to get into that, call it Ain't No New Thing, and talk about some people. Cultural rape and no geographical boundaries on white hate and bizarre, scarcely concealed attempts to eliminate black generators of sun heat feeling. Ain't no new thing to see demon fangs curling out from under squeezed tight too thin lips and leaping at jugular veins in burning black throats that either blow or sing or cry or scream. Ain't no new thing to see the bubbling envy flashing from the depths of soulless eyes as still another link with God is created. We used to having white people try to rob us. Why don't they try stealing some of this poverty? Ain't no new thing. Anything they can't understand, they try to destroy. Anything they can't understand, they try to control. In 1896, black men picked up brass instruments and began to evoke and conjure, entice and struggle with black spirits, rhythmic spirits of blues, work songs, gospel songs, freedom songs, and songs of love of Mother Night. Screaming rhythm, juju, rhythm, voodoo, rhythm, black magic that calls back to lost worlds and lost lifestyles, calling back to lost peace and peace of mind, calling back to Genesis, calling back to the drum, calling back to the drum, calling back to the first song chant that original man created. In 1896, this new spasm was called ass, but the ass would not be kicked. So it was copied in an attempt to control it, and then it was called jazz. We used to having black innovators copied and sent back to us. What about the Osmond Brothers? What about Elvis Presley? What about Tom Jones? We used to having people try to rob us. It ain't no new thing. They used the media to project their jazz idols. Tommy Dorsey and Jimmy Dorsey and Harry James and Benny Goodman, and I suppose someday Lawrence Welk will join that elite group. And then there was sweet Bessie Smith laying on the blood-soaked backseat of that broken-down jalopy with a tattered quilt wrapped around her shoulders, waiting for someone to come to her aid on a rainy Mississippi night, while a white hospital will not accept her right across the street. Ain't no new thing. Fats Navarro screaming through tormenting dreams, frustration ripping at his mind and bowels, over 100 pounds melted from his frame as he battled that white powder mountain. Ain't no new thing. Cultural rape and no geographical boundaries on white hate hide black musicians away in funky, smoke-filled nightclubs, the Chitlin' Circuit, saturate their worlds with two-bit punks, washed-out baggy-faced white whores, weasel-faced yellow-skinned junkies, and cutthroat white managers, producers, agents, owners, and on and on and on. We used to having white people try to rob us. Ain't no new thing. We have dug his game. Charlie Parker will live on. John Coltrane will live on. Eric Dolphy will live on. Billie Holiday will live on. Jimi Hendrix and Clifford Brown and Lee Morgan will live on and on in the sunshine of their accomplishments, the glory of the dimensions that they added to our lives. We declare war on Eric Burdon. We discredit the talents of Janis Joplin and Rare Earth. We urge that the next blue-eyed soul group include Melvin Laird, Lyndon Johnson, Nixon, and Spearhead Agnew and be called As the Stomach Turns. We urge that the album John Wayne Sings the Blues be released. Release the album J. Edgar Hoover Sings James Brown. Release the album Wallace and Maddox Sing Sam and Dave. Why not? We hear Tony the Tiger sing, "Right on, Tiger." We heard Nixon talking about power to the people. It ain't no new thing. 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 America is always the same old shit.
Boy. One more from the immortal Gil Scott Heron.
We want to do a poem for one of our unfavorite people who's now the head of the Nixon campaign. He was formerly the attorney general named John Mitchell. Nixon's campaign seems to be out, you know, getting off on a rather hip foot after his trip to China in the name of peace, while they were killing people right across the street, so to speak, in North and South Vietnam. But No Knock, the law in particular, was allegedly legislated for black people rather than, you know, for their destruction. And it means simply that authorities and members of the police force no longer have to knock on your door before entering. They can now knock your door down. It's No Knock. You explained it to me, I must admit, but just for the record, you were talking shit. Long rap about No Knock being legislated for the people you've always hated in this hellhole that we call home. No knock, the man will say, to keep that man from beating his wife. No knock, the man will say, to protect people from themselves. No knocking, head rocking, enter shocking, shooting, cussing, killing, crying, lying, and being white. No knock. No knocked on my brother Fred Hampton, bullet holes all over the place. No knocked on my brother Michael Harrison, jammed a shotgun against his skull. For my protection, who's gonna protect me from you? The likes of you, the nerve of you, to talk that shit face to face, your tomato face deadpan, your deadpan deadening another freedom plan. No knocking, head rocking, enter shocking, shooting, cussing, killing, crying, lying, and being white.
But if you're wise, no-knocker, you'll tell your no-knocking lackeys, ha, no-knock on my brother's head, no-knock on my sister's head, no-knock on my brother's head, no-knock on my sister's head, and double-lock your door, because soon someone may be no-knocking, ha, ha, for you. No-knock, to be slipped into John Mitchell's suggestion box.
That goes a long ways back, doesn't it? Before Black Lives Matter and Antifa. Oh, man. That's I think that's before George Papadoc Bush, even Daddy Bush, got in on this. Coming up now is a classic that came out during George Bush Jr. Remember him? I know some of you young people may not even remember him. Listen to the Radio Free Kansas. Yeah, the No Weapons of Mass Destruction, no WMD, Bush. This is a classic. And after that, we'll get John Grant on the telephone. Are you ready? This came out back in the early 90s. Well, no, I lose track of which war. Iraq.
President, they want that name. Republican. I hate that old Republican Party.
Yes, coming up, John Grant. We'll have John Grant on. I never thought of that, but leave it to the New York Times and Mitch Smith, the reporter, This isn't an editorial. This isn't an opinion piece, listeners.
No, this is a news story. News story, yeah.
Yeah. And I was real impressed with the article because, well, you pointed it out to me first, and then I've been reading the article.
Mm-hmm.
Is that this is the first Roe vote on abortion in the United States.
Right
now.
Right, exactly. And of all states, it's Kansas, which, as you know intimately, has a long history of volatile history of abortion conflicts. And, you know, obviously you can take it back to John Brown and other conflicts, you know, that you're a very volatile state. And so, yeah, this is the first vote, you know, that people can use their electoral powers to make statements. And what was interesting to me, and I think what's interesting with the New York Times is, coming from, of course, the liberal coastal Northeast, how viable, and ironically, this is. You'd think red state Kansas, the yes votes would just swamp, but apparently it's not the case, that it's a closer vote than one might think. Is that, what do you think?
It's really a case of people becoming more aware of, especially the young people in the states. There's a real chance, there's a real tendency since the fall of Donnie Trump.
Right.
That there's a real tendency in Kansas. For the first time since I think the 1930s. The most populated county in the state, Johnson County, overwhelmingly supported Joe Biden, and that's a really big first for this Republican-soaked state.
Right.
So I attribute that largely to the rise of the, you know, a lot of people just don't want to protest like Black Lives Matter. We had Black Lives Matter protests, and we had.
Sure.
You know, there are anti-fascists in the state, very few.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a way where many, many young people, 20-somethings and 30-somethings,
mm-hmm.
can get involved. And I see this. It's a groundswell. It really is a profound groundswell.
I get a sense of it. It's really interesting, yeah. This groundswell
people, well,
idea.
Here's the thing. Yeah, well, it really is. I mean, it began in 2020, which wasn't that long ago, and I see a continuance. Now, that doesn't guarantee it. Another good thing is that we have more independent. I call them independent. The state calls them unaffiliated voters than Democrats.
Right.
And I don't mean to demean the Democratic Party, the Kansas Democratic Party, in any way, but for far too long they supported anti-choice or, quote, pro-life, unquote, candidates in the state, even as some of the most violent forms of domestic terrorism were committed in the state against abortion doctors and abortion providers and their nurses.
Exactly.
You know, I lived through that, and this is the important thing. At a certain point, when a terrorist movement was quickly taking over the sentiments of the Republican base in Kansas. Now, this is we're talking 1994 up to 2008. There was a terrorist movement, a domestic terrorist movement in this state. That permeated the churches and permeated the Kansas Republican Party, and it was sort of and it became such a profound experience that many, many people in the Kansas Democratic Party shut their mouths.
Right.
And I think it was just out of fear, and I give them that out. I give them that excuse. You know.
Well, you know what it sounds like and feels like to me, and this is I've always been fascinated with. This, you know, dealing with you and the show here, and putting my head in Kansas for an hour, you know, that there's something going on, it seems to me, in the context of Kansas we're talking about, where it's post-Republican Democrat. In other words, as you say, it's so polarized with, you know, modern Trumpian Republicans hating Democrats and, you know, all this stuff. And so once that can be transcended and you move beyond and you're no longer even liberal conservative, you know, you're or even Democrat Republican, but you have people that are looking at the lives around them, looking at the situations around them, and they're saying to themselves, well, what am I going to do here? You know, I want a reasonable life. I want a good life. I don't care if it's Democrat, Republican, or whatever the fuck it is, but these people have some moral quotient involved in this, you know? And so it's beyond liberal conservative, beyond all the identifications. And so it's to me, it's someone in Alex's DeForest fire has completely destroyed things. But yet there's always the new growth. This new growth just loves popping up in this stuff. So that, you know, liberalism, of course, which the United States is based on with Jeffersonian democracy, et cetera, blah, 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 that, you know, out of the darkness, in a sense, that enlightenment ideas sort of generate out of this post-Republican Democrat context. Does that make any sense? Or
well, out here mm-hmm. it does, but
yeah, okay.
it was slow coming. I mean, it's
right,
slow coming.
Of course, well earned.
You have it took a lot of violence to make a lot of
right.
people intimidated. As I said earlier, I think
right.
many, many, I would say
mm-hmm.
hundreds of thousands of people
right.
were intimidated by the experience
right.
of the late 90s and early 2000s.
To me, that means that you have a leg up on us, if you will. It's an odd way to put it, but because you have experienced this digital age, it wasn't digital age when you experienced it, but this idea of a, quote, civil war amongst Americans. I mean, you've gotten a taste of that in back in the 90s, as you suggest. And so, you know, Kansas, again, I say John Brown's history, you know, you have a very volatile history of violent politics in Kansas. And so, you know, a lot of people, conservative, liberal, I don't care what I don't want some kind of modern digital civil war going on in my country. I want stability, you know, and I'm a moral person, you know, and so I think, you know, that there's room for sort of fundamental natural liberalism, if you will, to sort of appear in this post-party, post-partisan kind of mindset. I don't know. It just interests me. I don't quite understand it, but I enjoy, thinking about it and watching it there in Kansas, where you live.
Well, it's the extremism also of corporate wealth.
Of course.
Merging with the so-called religious right. And
right.
I think you used a key word there the situation has gotten in such a situation now that
mm-hmm.
people have to commit
right.
one way or the other on this constitutional amendment. And, I got to remind Kansas listeners, you know,
mm-hmm.
Charles Koch, I am firmly convinced, is for abortion, is probably
yeah.
an atheist, and he probably
right.
has done some hallucinogenic drugs in the Rocky Mountains on my best. And he did it with his wife, Elizabeth.
Oh, good.
I don't think is her name. So I'm just smearing the plutocrat, the in-state plutocrat, because
uh-huh.
he and a guy named Bobby Love of Love
mm-hmm.
Box Company in Wichita, which has been sold
mm-hmm.
And no longer exists as such, both were hardcore. He married Bobby Love. It wasn't a homosexual marriage that I know of, but he
okay.
he politically
right.
merge himself with the religious right. Bobby right. Love was a notorious, crazy Christian type guy. He wasn't really a Christian. He was a heretic, but like most people.
But
most
he had love in his name. Maybe love in his name.
Most yeah. most Christians in Kansas are heretics. You know, they're not really Christians. And the word you use, which is I direct an appeal to Republicans, is to be reasonable Republicans.
Well, there you go.
And if, reasonable Republicans have to realize that the outlawing of probably the most efficient of birth controls,
right.
abortion, early first term and early second trimester abortions, is it's the end all, but right. it's like your public library.
Mm-hmm.
It's the last social safety net a woman
yeah.
can have. The public library is the last social safety net for self-education out of deep
uh-huh.
poverty. That's what the public library is. Poor people can go in and read
right.
and teach themselves out. Well, that's what abortion
well, they
is.
Well, they also
women.
Use the Internet. They can go to Wikipedia, et cetera, yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
So this is the last social safety net for women. Kansas and other states who come here,
right?
And I think reasonable Republicans can understand that. I do.
Right.
I do.
Exactly.
I do
and I'm talking about reasonable Republicans, sort of getting fed up with this pissing contest of polarization between Democrats and Republicans that can get so absurd and hysterically out of hand. I think. People on the right are fed up with that. A lot of good people on the right are fed up with that. And so, you know, if you can sort of transcend the parties and, you know, all agree on reasonable things so we can have a structure in the future that works, it's an interesting dynamic, to talk about, because I was surprised, the front page story to suggest that the first vote, state vote, of all places in Kansas after the Roe decision, you know, that it was a close call. I would have thought it wasn't close at all. And, of course, we'll see when after the election. But and it's, I don't know, it's just very interesting. When is this election anyway? I forget.
August 2nd.
Next Tuesday.
Ironically, it'll be on our the day of our show.
Okay.
We try to get John Grant on.
We can encourage people to get out there before 7 o'clock and vote.
I would like to inform the listeners the depth. Now we walked through the gross acts of terrorism, bombing the bombing clinics, shooting Dr. Tiller, George Tiller, in his own church. You know, we walked through the terrorism. But I would like
well,
to
as
walk
a,
through
I,
how
you know, just to, in case everybody doesn't know this, I just read this is that of course Dr. Tiller's clinic was bombed, as you point out, in the '80s. He was shot in both arms in the 90s, and then he was murdered, shot in the head in 2000s. So this guy is a
in his own church.
Incredible martyr for this outrage. Yeah.
He was killed in his own church. Let's get that straight.
Right,
he was a Christian.
Right.
So
like Oscar Romero in El Salvador, I was just writing about.
And we had a It wasn't just him. There was a whole wave of terrorism. Many doctors who provided abortions dropped out in Kansas. They quit.
Intimidation, absolutely.
In the late 80s, after Tiller's clinic was bombed, the University of Kansas Medical Center, and I know this because I was dating at that time a doctor, a young doctor, who was in medical school. And in response, this is more the cowardice, you know, that people have.
Sure.
When his clinic was bombed, immediately the Kansas University Medical Center, the biggest hospital in the state, that teaches doctors, a teaching hospital, stopped doing abortions. They stopped teaching students how to do abortions. They immediately stopped. All they did was show them what to do in the case of a miscarriage, and they told the students who wanted to learn how to do abortions skillfully, okay, and professionally, they told them they had to fly at their own expense to Colorado to learn how to do that. So the cowardice in Kansas, I attribute to a very large middle class and distracted people until the last 20, and it's been slow these last 20 years. But I think Donald Trump teabagged a lot of people, a lot of Republicans in Kansas. Republicans are becoming more reasonable after the experience of Donald Trump and the January 6th riots at the Capitol building. And I do think that's another attributing factor towards this, what I call a groundswell.
The gloss on Donald Trump is wearing off. I think they're relentlessly in the House of Representatives hearings, of course, and now we're getting rumblings from Merrick Garland that he is investigating Donald Trump specifically, and so I think they're going to indict him somewhere, and there will be a trial for the ex-president of the United States. I'm convinced of that. Now, to me, that could be the end of Trump. In other words, the far right could say, well, he's no longer useful. He's no longer doing us any good. He's now a burden. He's a drag on our movement and, a drag on, if you will, the Trumpism movement so that he can be jettisoned, kick him to the curb, throw him over the side. In Central America, there was Anastasio Somoza, and then, there was always a talk of, well, if Somoza's gone, Somozismo, if you will, could still prevail, even though Somoza was gone. Well, I think that dynamic works here. You could have, Trump essentially kicked to the curb, and Trumpism, with the governor of Florida, DeSantis, et cetera, picking up the cudgel from Trump. And so we're still in the same game, but magic, whatever Trump, spread around the country over these, white backlash elements, they'll move on to somebody else. I see that happening, and hopefully that'll have some impact in this thing, this vote.
Well, I still advise my Republican friends to be, if reasonable Republicans must right. know that Vice President Mike Pence is just a cheap copy of Senator Sam Brownback, former sure. Senator Brownback, and right. and Governor Brownback. And these cheap copies are not going to help the country in any way. It's just going to further divide the country with religious extremism of any form.
Right. Pence has suddenly had a flip up here. I thought he was dead meat, completely dead meat. It's like, you got to be kidding me. This guy who, kissed Donald Trump's feet for 4 years, suddenly now, because Donald Trump was fine with people wanting to hang him and all this, suddenly he's kind of got this flip up that he's a profile in courage, that he, he went and did his job that day, January 6th, and, that he's now politically viable. I, of course, don't see it, but it's interesting. And I can even see, in fact, two of his aides have testified voluntarily before the January 6th hearings. And so, I can even conceive of Pence, stooling on Donald Trump and giving the goods on him and, you know, hang the son of a bitch, and out of that, Pence becomes politically viable. I don't know. It's all a big mystery. Who knows what's going to happen?
Well, one of those Pence aides you were talking about,
right,
appeared before a grand jury yesterday. His name is Mark
right.
Short. Now there's a Kansas connection to that, to Mark Short.
Okay.
He ran Freedom Works and Americans for Profit. He dispersed mm-hmm. money. He was a big shot with
okay.
the Charles Koch's outrageous. You know, this is, you know, he threw money everywhere, you know,
mm-hmm.
and Mark Short was one of the guys that dispersed the money from Charles Koch. Check it out, Freedom Works.
Mm-hmm.
He was for years ahead of that. So the bugaboo and magical thinking of the of people who actually seriously believe in a virgin birth of 2,000 years ago or something like that. It's still playing a powerful role in the state of Kansas government,
uh-huh, uh-huh,
and
uh-huh.
even and they're going to continue to get economic sustenance from the plutocrat like Charles Koch here in the state.
Yeah. Yeah.
But what here, and this is the diabolical part of this. This August 2nd,
uh-huh.
this next Tuesday,
right.
was pushed through the state legislature because they know the least amount of voters turn out on primaries. August
mm-hmm.
2nd is the primary for
right.
both Democrat and Republican parties in the state of Kansas.
Right.
So, you know, in the past, nobody shows up except the faithful of both parties to do primaries. Right? Now,
right.
as a concession to this one ballot, and this is another confusion, many Kansas know. Well, I can't even, but unaffiliated. The largest number of voters in Kansas are more than Democrats, and they're not unaffiliated or independent. And many
right.
of them suspected that they were not going to be able to vote in the primary ballots next Tuesday because they're not a member of any party.
Mm-hmm.
Now what has happened as an
mm-hmm.
emergency stopgap
mm-hmm.
When they pushed this through last year, by the way,
uh-huh. okay,
they as a concession, they allowed
mm-hmm.
independent voters. So if you're not registered in any
wow.
party, you should
right.
still go in Tuesday. Now that was a concession,
right?
To
well,
people like
the situation and dynamic in context you do describe suggests to me that one of the keys is what factions are driven and motivated to get out and vote for this, quote, primary that's open to independents. In other words, who is motivated the most to get their troops out? And if the Roe vote, arguably, is that motivation. I mean, they talked about it. It was so egregious with these guys who had all lied to the Senate that they, you know, that Roe was established law. And then they, you know, I mean, in a giddy mood, they all just slammed it and crushed it, you know, and you could tell the delight, the vengeance that, like, somebody like Clarence Thomas had been, you know, harboring in his heart that, God, now he was able to slash and burn and get some vengeance for his, you know, high-class lynching that he said, you know, that was done to him. Here we are. You know, that is so egregious, and people talked about it, of course, after that Roe was eliminated, that, you know, this people are not going to forget this. And so you wonder if the people on the pro-abortion side in Kansas would be especially motivated to get their asses out and to vote for this. Do you think that's a dynamic to think about here, that this could happen?
Well, I think what's going on is a lot of the people that are sort of undecided on this issue
right.
are as yet unaware, because most people don't pay attention like I do or others
right.
To the state, how they write these goddamn laws, and then slide them through. And they're even and sneaky. This was a sneaky move to put it on a primary election day. I watch them. They're very sneaky little. They're sneaky little guys, heretics, you know. And
right.
And they're all fueled by, you know, hey, if I play this right, I get another, you know, $10,000, $20,000, $50,000, $100,000 mm-hmm. in campaign donations from Koch Industries in Wichita. It really is. It really is. If I play this right. So that was a sneaky move. But here's another sneaky move. If I can, I'm going to outline two of them that have already on the books and ready to pass. Two laws. One is that they're going to declare the pregnancy of any pregnancy is an unborn child. It's not a zygote. It's not a fetus. It doesn't go through any morphological changes from a non-sentient cluster of cells to a zygote, which is, if you ever look at a picture of a zygote, it has a tail like a reptile.
Yeah, it looks like insect larvae, you know. It's like,
Well, it's got sort of a fishy thing,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, it does. It's got
gill slits.
Right, and so the establishment, they've tried to do this for decades. You know, the establishment, the idea
they've done it
that the potential life in a woman's womb
they wave hands over the woman's belly and start reminiscing and talking about what that thing is thinking about, how it's going to get its next driver's license. What car is daddy going to buy me, you know? And they pray over it, and they go on and on and on and on. This state hasn't even passed the expansion of Medicaid for it's really poor people to have any medical help. This state, but let's get to this. That was my first point. That's right there in the book. It'll happen.
Okay.
If they don't defeat this, if we don't keep the Kansas Constitution like it is and vote no. Here's another thing, and it's a dirtier one, okay, as I alluded to earlier about not teaching doctors, young doctors, how to do abortions, okay, at the University of Kansas Medical Center.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the dirtier one. It's called, I think, and I might have the number wrong, and it probably won't matter because they'll slide it through committee. It was Senate Bill 250, and it passed, I think 2019. And what that does is it outlaws the use of dilation and extraction. It outlaws doctors, put it in plain language. It forbids doctors or makes it a crime for doctors to use any tool whatsoever to even help a woman after a miscarriage. I mean, let alone abortion. They're not even allowed to use tools to help a woman cleanse her uterus after a miscarriage. Now, I have a friend I just talked to him on the phone last night, and he pointed out that his ex-wife and him, they have two beautiful children. They have a very living, you know, their divorce that's very amiable. They're both very successful people. They're economically successful people. But never mind. And he's in Kansas. And he pointed out his wife had like three miscarriages during or around the period of trying to have these two kids, you know. Mm-hmm. And he realized that if they took away the tools, and this is what Senate Bill 250 is laying in a nest right now, pigeonholed, ready to be pulled out as soon as this amendment to the Constitution goes, if it goes through, is that without the use of a simple DNX or cleaning out the woman's uterus, she may have been permanently ruined. And it's a common known fact among doctors that sepsis, poisoning of the blood system, will, you know, it's a leading way of killing a woman if you don't do this procedure after a miscarriage. And then there's taking away the tools of doctors, even you know, practicing art and making it illegal for them to use their tools is one of the most diabolic, one of the most diabolical laws they've attempted to pass in the state of Kansas. And it's, and it's a sick law. It's a sicker law than really anything that the so-called pro-life people.
You can argue, and I'm arguing this kind of I'm writing a piece now on my friend Roy Bourgeois, Mary Knoll priest, who has been excommunicated by Pope Benedict, you know, the who was he, the Nazi Pope or whatever they called him, Ratzo Risinger or whatever his name was. He was excommunicated, and now he has, and the reason he was excommunicated is because he attended the ordination of a woman and advocated the ordination of women priests. Well, this set off, you know, ballistic bells in the Pentagon, the Vatican, and, you know, he was run out, and he could find no allies. All these friends of his, priests, they wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole. It was a third rail. And he's now written a little book, which I'm writing about, I read, in which he advocates, you know, it's the outrage of the fact that women cannot be priests in this institution that is run by men, is one of the most corrupt, wealthiest institutions in the world, and of course has a problem of, you know, priests molesting young boys, and, you know, they can't marry, and so, you know, the priesthood becomes a haven for, you know, certain homosexuals who, you know, don't want to participate, you know, and they have a free ride. They're celibate. They don't have to, you know, prove anything. And so the problems with it being all male are so egregious and so clear that, you know, his arguing in 2022 for women priests, it plays into this whole argument of this backlash that we're living in, you know, in the secular world, which is ruled now by a Supreme Court of 9 judges who lived there or worked there forever until they croak. And what, 7 out of 9 are Catholics, Roman Catholics, you know? And you wonder, like, how fucked up can you get, you know, of this idea that, you know, what women contribute to the world, which is nurturance and all this, Malraux, the famous French writer, André Malraux, wrote in Man's Fate, you know, that he said, he's talking about in violence and wars and things, and how men see life in a dead body. In other words, this motivates them, death motivates them to go out and, you know, do things in the world because we're mortal and we die, and you watch people die, it just motivates. But where women, he says, what they're motivated by is a baby, an infant, a new life, and nurturing that thing, you know. I read that back in the 70s, and it always resonates in my mind as something connected to Freud's idea of Eros and Thanatos and the life principle, the death principle, all that deep shit, you know. And what we're seeing is an effort to, you know, make America great again, if you will, by, you know, what conquered the Indians and what enslaved black people from Africa was male cruelty, is abuse and all of that stuff, violence and death and torture and rape and all that kind of stuff that Freud would put under the death instinct of Thanatos, is what they're trying to resurrect, because this was America's power. Richard Slotkin wrote a trilogy of books called The Regeneration Through Violence, in which he looked back at American history when things started to fall, difficulties with the American project, if you will, it just ratcheted up the violence. every time. This is how America solved its problems, by regeneration, regenerating things through the use of violence as a tool. Well, we're seeing it right now in spades. So my buddy Roy Wajvan, trying to figure this out in the corrupt institution of the Catholic Church, is just all part of the larger picture going on of all this stuff. And the goat in all this is women. It's not only women, it's sensitive people in general, if you will. In other words, like Roy Bourgeois, a priest who struggles. You know, I got to know him through all these demonstrations at Fort Benning in Georgia about the, you know, the people that have been abused and slaughtered and raped by people taught at the School of the Americas in Georgia. All of that stuff. I'm sort of going off here a little unusually, or a little chaotically, I suppose, but it seems to be it's all connected. It's all connected. And that it is a movement on women. You know, women have gone too far, you know. And it's a backlash against women, and I think you see it a lot of places. And you see it in the Roe v. Wade being abolished. You see it, you know, in what Roy's doing in the Catholic Church. I don't know. What do you make of that? It's a
boy. That's some profound shit, Sean Grant.
I think it is. I think it is. Because but it's how do you get a grip on it? You know what I mean? Because everybody understands how America, the strength of America, is rooted in violence. I mean, everybody wants to be a macho tough guy, you know?
It's rooted in many things. Violence seems to be a key part of it. I agree. Force, the use of force, you know, the expansion of the territories, you know, all this stuff, you know. We've sort of reached the limit of that, the limit of growth. But, no, I tend to think I've got this idea in my head, and it's worked in the past. I sort of like some of the Catholics, you know?
Especially so do I. I mean, I have some of my heroes in life, like Roe Bourgeois or Catholic.
It's just that, there are some Catholics, especially ones that drink, I sort of enjoy. I usually drink with them.
I'm with you.
and I always would tease them, and they would agree. You know, I'm a heathen to some of them, and I would say that, you know, I'm just a heathen, you know that. And they would
come in the same role.
They would nod their head over their can of beer, and usually some of the women would watch because they wondered where I was going with this, and I say, well, you got a leg up on it because all you got to do tomorrow morning, Saturday, is get up and go and talk to the box. You're okay. You're out of it. You're still going to heaven.
Right.
There's one wife of this guy who goes, what do you mean, talk to the box? It's a confession. You go to the confession, you confess, and well, he never goes to confession. Well, you know, tell him to. I notice you're having marital problems. Why don't you go talk to the box?
Right.
You know,
talk to the guy who knows nothing about marriage.
Yeah, and just relax a little bit. He might. You know.
Right.
And I point out to him that I ran into a monk. He was not. He only became a priest because they couldn't give a job.
A brother, I guess they call him a brother rather than a father.
I ran into a brother up at a bar, and we had a long, wonderful discussion about macrobiology and evolution.
Oh yeah,
and he told me, he says, well, you know, I teach this at Benedictine College. I used to. I taught it for 20 years.
Yeah.
Benedictine College, which is just 20 miles away, you know.
Sure.
I said, really? And I go, that's inspiring that you. We've acknowledged evolution for at least 150 years, Mike. You know, but he said the problem is, he says we've got people on the outside of the church and people on top of the church who are. You know, they're shaking collection plates. You know, they don't care about science. You know, and this guy, this monk, was a really nice guy. I got to know him, played some games of chess with him and stuff. And he ended up He ended up becoming an Episcopalian.
Ended what?
Episcopal priest. What?
I lost it. Something garbled what? There. He ended up as
he
what?
He ended up becoming. He ended up being an Episcopalian priest.
Ah.
He quit the Catholic Church and became an Episcopalian.
Well, they say the Episcopalians are the most high church, and a little bit of the Lutherans as well. But, you know, Episcopalians are like Catholicism without Catholicism or something, you know.
Well.
They wear these crinkly outfits and have big hats and
I saw the same monk. He's now an Episcopalian priest. He doesn't drink as much. He's very older. He's old now.
Well, he's wise and dumb.
And I said, so wait a minute. What's going on here?
Uh-huh.
It's good to see you. I haven't seen you in like 10 years. And he goes, yeah, that's okay. I said, you mean Henry VIII had it right? he laughed. Because essentially, Episcopalian is the Church of England. You know,
exactly.
Anyone knows
right.
that history will know that. and Henry VIII rammed it through so he
right.
the divorce and cut off the
right. He wanted to kill all his wives and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. And we had a good laugh over that. And he's I'm glad to see that he successfully retired and doing part time work as a priest of the Church of England. So I cut a wide swath around.
Uh-huh.
Catholics normally, but I ran into too many who will probably vote against
right.
changing the state constitution. You know, honestly, they're privately
fair enough.
Pro-choice.
Well, I want to, after saying what you've just said, I want to make it clear that I agree 100% with you, that I have run into some of the greatest people I ran into in my life, especially in Central America, were bloody Catholics. You know, these people were courageous, good-hearted, compassionate people who were, you know, sacrificing and risking their lives to do great things, like my friend, you know, Father Roy Bourgeois, who was a wounded Vietnam vet and a Marianole priest, a great man. And anyway, so I'm with you. Yeah, there are many very fine, admirable Catholics. I don't want to run down the members of that church, although I still submit that the Catholic, Roman Catholic Church, if you will, has to be one of the most corrupt institutions on the fucking planet. Pardon the expression. It's a mixed bag. Life is complicated. It's like the military. You know, I have a lot of problems with the institution of the military and how our government employs it. But at the same time, life is complex, and there are many wonderful people wearing the uniform of the military in the United States, you know, so... Life is complicated, yes.
Yeah, it is. It's not as it's not a black and white issue anymore.
No, it's not.
So I think there is more than a better chance that the self-described pro-choice people in the state of Kansas or the reasonable
mm-hmm.
Republicans
right.
could defeat this attempt to change the state constitution. I think there is
wow.
a good chance. It's a running chance. You know, it's a horse race.
Right. Yeah, be amazing if it did happen? Again, we don't know.
Well, here's the big deal. Here's Mitch Smith's article in the New York Times. It started this
okay.
with you
mm-hmm.
and I.
Sure, right.
He sort of missed, I think he missed a lot of that, and he used
mm-hmm.
the thing, I think one of the cut lines, the captions,
mm-hmm.
somewhere here. It's at the bottom of the article. He says, and he quotes another, a Catholic, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
No,
mm-hmm.
he's a Baptist. A Baptist,
okay.
Jesse Nolan out of Salina. He says, it's kind of more trench warfare. This is a quote. It's kind of more trench warfare. Everybody is
uh-huh.
dug in on one side or the other.
Right.
Roland. Pastor Roland, Baptist pastor, Roland said, nobody's
okay.
talking, really, from what I've observed. It's kind of more trench warfare. Everybody's
uh-huh.
dug in on one side or the other. And nobody's talking, really, from what I observe. That, well,
with
Pastor
each other,
Roland,
you mean?
Well, Pastor Roland's got his head up his ass. I mean, he's still in the position. There's no talking to Pastor Roland of the Baptist Church because he doesn't stick his head up out of his ass or
right.
out of his own church.
Right.
To talk to anybody.
He's hiding up in there. You can't get at him.
I mean, he doesn't talk to reasonable Republicans in his own.
Right.
He's already ran most of them out of the church. So, I mean, and by the way, here's an example. Here's an example, and we'll be real quick because we're 10 minutes. I drive north. I have to drive 4.5 miles. To get a box of wine or cigarettes or any of those sinful things, 4.5 miles, and I go up there and it's at the Nortonville Christian Church.
Mm-hmm.
It's right there on the corner of the highway, a vacant highway. It's just a big intersection.
Uh-huh.
And on it they have these stupid signs, and they're popping up everywhere. Of course, it says value them both. Vote yes. Mm-hmm. You know, they want to change the state constitution, and they want to give personhood, all the things we've outlined. They're against all that. They've got one. The first Christian Church of Nortonville has a sign, one of those signs in their front yard, and at the same. And then you got all these churches having their brick sign. It's brick with glass, and it has words on it. You know, that's like the message. You know. And it says, we welcome all. Now, I drove by there several times, and I thought, no, wait a minute. You welcome all people to come into your church, but you put up one of those goddamn signs out there in your front yard, you know? I mean, it's so blatantly hypocritical. I decided I was going to go by. My first thought was to go in there and tell the pastor, no, you got to put both signs up there, you know? But they're so brazen. It's like this guy I quoted. They're so brazen and they're so stuck in their way of thinking that they don't even want reasonable people in their churches. You know, I first thought I'd go in there and talk, and I said, no, you know, I have enough problems as it is, let alone having some. I've had a local pastor, you know, go on and on from the pulpit about my wife and me. We got through that after about 10 years. We've been out here 23 years.
Right,
it took
like
10 years to get over that. So I'm not going to go in there and pick an argument with the pastor. But then I thought, well, maybe I'll just stick one of these vote no signs in the front yard right alongside the vote yes sign, you know, and then they're both there. And then
are there a number of signs to vote no? I mean, does it have
not many, but I'm in a sparsely populated area. Now you go over to the bigger villages. They're all villages, John. None of them are really cities. And you do see more, you know. And I'm going to, you know, call my local Democrat. They're the only ones distributing vote no signs. You can make your own, by the way, listeners. You ought to make one.
Sure.
You know, out of cardboard.
Oh, absolutely. I'm making one for my yard. No, I got one I just drew and painted myself, hand painted. It says democracy C, an exclamation point, and down below in smaller letters says tyranny no.
Oh, that's neat. That's
I figured it was thoughtful enough and ambiguous enough that people would go by it, they'd see it once, twice, three times, four times, and thinking,
here?
You know, I mean, really set seeds in their mind that grow, you know,
Yeah, and I got to hand it to the PR guys that came up with, or gals that came up with the anti-constitution vote, the so-called yes vote, value them both. That's a cute slogan. And then they have a line drawing of what looks like the Madonna. I mean, it's a woman cradling a kid or an infant. You know, it's right out of the Virgin Mary shit. You know,
sure.
And yeah, they got us artistically on it. The Democrats came up with a just vote no, black background. But it doesn't matter because, like I said, the groundswell in the aftermath of Donald Trump and Mike Pence, hang Mike Pence. Hang
I know.
Pence.
I mean, the more you think about it, the more outrageous it gets. Yeah.
I think the people are sort of they're fed up with all this shit. I really do. I'm right with them on that.
Well, and also, I think there's we've been talking around this idea, but I think you talk about the idea of the hypocritical church, everybody's welcome, when you know that's not true, this whole idea of you only listen to people who are clones of your own thinking, you know, that after a while, you know, you become what the left has become is lost in little pondism. You know, you become so pure in your thoughts that you only allow in the thoughts of those who think exactly like you. So you can all, stroke yourselves and feel good. But it's also your pond is getting smaller and smaller as this is going on because you're not opening yourself to new recruits or new people, you know, people just across the fence that, you know, you might lure over to your side. And whereas the left, if you will, has to do that. It has no choice. Because the left has discovered that it is in a little pond, and a little pond is drying up, and the fish are flopping in the mud, and it's no longer, you know, a viable body of water. So, you know, you want to bring new people in and new water, and you get out in the ocean and all this, and, you know, all these silly metaphors I'm dealing with here. But, you can get too exclusive. And you know, your body of water will begin to dry up. And you know, that dynamic is real if you don't open yourself up to new things, new ideas and the future and all that kind of stuff. Because the only constant in life is change. And I don't know who said that, but whoever did, it's true. And so here we are, and we'll see what happens next Tuesday.
Yeah, I think we're on to something, John. Great show today. I mean,
I would encourage every Kansan to get out there and vote. Get out there and vote. Absolutely. And that would
be real news
out of Kansas if that vote no prevailed. That would be real news.
Oh, they could really lead the way. I mean, they could literally lead. Kansas can lead the way. They can lead the way
good luck
for the nation.
Good luck.
Really.